Hello everyone and welcome to the Smashy Business Show. Today is Monday, 23rd of June. The second quarter is nearly ending. It's the year 2025 and I'm Abdul Majid Awan.
And I'm Wart Ahmed and we've got a packed show for you today. Firstly, we're going to be discussing how Muhammad Al-Abbar, the founder of Imar and Noon, has launched a new AI-driven Arabic media platform, Lana. Iran is considering the Strait of Hormuz closure after the unprovoked U.S. strikes. And Valu is set to debut on the Egyptian exchange in a landmark fintech listing. And finally, airlines have rerouted their flights after the unprovoked U.S. strikes on Iran.
And the very first story, the very big story, one of the competitor story. We're also a media company, so we are keeping a close eye on all the competitors. If you guys follow us, you would know we kept a very close eye on Monify as well. But Emirati entrepreneur, the billionaire, the guy behind Imar, the guy behind Eagle Hills, the guy behind Noon, the guy behind so many things, Muhammad Al-Abbar, best known for founding Noon and Imar also, obviously, has officially launched a new regional media platform called Lana. I saw the website, I went through their Instagram. Looks interesting. The announcement came during a launch event held over the weekend.
So Lana is being positioned as an AI-powered Arabic news platform that aims to redefine how Arabic media is produced and consumed. Now, it's going to cover a wide range of topics from news and business to lifestyle and entertainment with a specific focus on personalization through data analytics.
And the platform is led by former Arabian business editors Majd Bahu and Matthew Amlot. Again, really interesting. Who now serves as editor-in-chief and general manager. Both bring years of experience in Middle Eastern media.
So speaking at the launch, Al-Abbar highlighted the impact of technology on operations. It was so interesting because he proceeded to call on the Noon CEO, Faraz Khalid, during the event, sharing how Noon once took a month to merchandise, but now it does it in just 15 minutes, you know, thanks to AI and like tech advancements.
And with Lana, Al-Abbar is expanding his footprint beyond real estate and e-commerce into media. The platform promises to deliver fast, intelligent, and user-friendly Arabic content. Not English, only Arabic. Marking a bold bet on AI as the future of news. It's really interesting.
I think for me, what I found more interesting is the fact that the Matthew Amlot, you know, one of the directors that they have hired, I don't think he knows Arabic. He probably will lead in strategy. But you know how the story actually goes is that the actual man behind all of this is Anel Bayrou. Believe that is what his name is. He used to be the former editor-in-chief of ITP Media.
Nice.
And I was reading his caption, Majid, and you know what he basically said? He went to Muhammad Al-Abbar with the sketch of the entire idea. About Lana, and Muhammad Al-Abbar was very quick to say yes and back the entire venture. So really, it's between Muhammad Al-Abbar. So I'm guessing that's why, you know, they have Arabian business editors who are part of the entire operation. I think when I take a look at this, it's really telling you how important media is becoming.
Yeah.
Because, you know, what media controls everything now. And what do billionaires want more in this world than control?
It's the fourth pillar of state, you know? It's the fourth pillar of state because there's three pillars, the executive, the judiciary, and there's another one, constitution, not something. But after that, bureaucracy. So the fourth one is considered media as because media keeps an eye on all the basic systems which keep the government, which keep the countries, which keep a nation state running. So yeah, a good initiative. There's only two things that I would like to highlight. Let's give it time, obviously. We'll see how it goes. They have 4,000-ish followers on Instagram. They have a good website. Again, I can read Arabic. I can understand bits of it, but I didn't get exactly what they're trying to do. Maybe they're trying to be Monify. Maybe they're trying to be smashy business.
There's a mix. There's a mix of lifestyle and business there, right? There was this one article that I saw that they've written about Al Walid bin Talal, the Saudi billionaire, and basically the entire article was about how, you know, the Saudi billionaire, he's back and he's at the top of the Forbes list. You know, it was old news, but you know, it. I see what they're trying to
fill up. Fill it up with something before the launch, because when you go to on the platform, you actually see a lot of stuff being uploaded. So I think they wanted to like saturate it with content. So if anyone lands on the page, unlike This is Dubai page, which was recently started by former Khaleej Times editor. This is Dubai. He also started it, but they had a different strategy. They started and then went on to start posting. These guys, they already have content on their platforms.
I think that's good. I think it's a soft launch before they actually say who they are. So they're probably testing new formats out.
But what, you know, seeing for if they work. Like the people who speak English, why only Arabic? Maybe they move into English eventually.
But I think there is a space for that, and that more platforms need to be in Arabic for the Arabic.
Have you seen Blinks, right? You always quote Blinks.
They're in Blinks.
Arabic. They have like millions of followers. They're great at storytelling. They're very spicy storytelling, but they are great at visualization of the stories and everything. So it doesn't compete with only one brand. It will go on and compete with a lot of established brands. I remember the speech, I was listening to it, Rich was there, I think. In the video, he says something about that our legacy media, the traditional media, they have done a great job. But he was like, now the shift has already happened. I think he jumped on the bandwagon a lot late because the shift has already happened. It's not a market where you enter and you'd be like, oh, this is a new market and I'm the first one, or I'm one of the first ones. The market is already saturated. So he jumped in a lot late. I think he got the idea late from the guy that you're talking about. But again, the problem is that he enters a saturated market. The Alabar name is very big. That is going to be one of the reasons that maybe it gets a lot of traction in the start. But eventually, the Alabar name can only carry them so much. Eventually, they will need to do good content. And what I've seen, visually, they're good. Let's see content-wise how they do.
No, but it's like Majid, like what you mentioned in the beginning, you know, Monify.
Yeah.
I think what this is showing me is that, you know, there is clearly a trend that is happening where billionaires are seeing, you know, they're seeing the potential in media and they're launching their own media companies.
Not only last media, year, digital media.
Exactly. Last
they don't
year
want to
in,
go to TV and all that, right?
But then I'll go into that later. Last year in November, Naguib Soueiris, the Egyptian billionaire, part of, you know, one of the richest families in Africa, he launched Monify in Dubai. There was a huge launch event. You know, 3 months later, they laid off over 80% of the staff. But that's like beside the point. It's the fact that you have these billionaires who are coming in and they're launching these digital media companies because they're seeing the rise of content creators.
Yeah.
You know, they're seeing how much money, the stream of money that is actually going into media. It is absolutely crazy, especially with content creators. Like, Majid, you do not even have to be someone important anymore with a million followers. You just have to have a group of people who like you and follow you and engage
audience.
With you. Exactly. And brands will want to partner with you.
It's the idea of micro-influencers, because there was a time when 2 million, 10 million followers were the go-to place. People would go to, I won't take the name, but everyone knows the biggest YouTube vlog person here. His name has vlogs in it. But he has a lot of following. People will go to him, pay him a lot of money, and get one video out of him, one reel maybe, anything. Now that same, if for example they have a budget of 100K, they divide that same budget into 50 people who are working on the same niche, has small 10K, 20K audience. They get more delivery, do more deliverables, like more goals are achieved, more efficiency is there in the process. So yeah, micro influencers are working. So if you're an influencer or willing to be an influencer, the best time is now. Again, it's not a new entry market. Everything is already saturated. But if you still think there is something new, you can always jump in and have that niche and have that small following and still somehow make money or at least get partnerships, get visibility through something. A lot of events here, some of the influencers, they go and they get freebies, a lot of freebies, even though they just post a story and like do 5 stories and maybe a reel. But they get a lot of stuff, so it's a good field to go in. I think this idea also is kind of like what the brands that we have, like we have Smashy Business, we have Smashy Sports, we have Love in Dubai. It's kind of like the creator economy. We are also part of the creator economy. We don't have a face for Love in Dubai, like we don't have a mascot or anything. We have the face of the founder, Rich is there. But it's, again, it's the digital, I think, identity of Love in Dubai that we sell. Right, the stories and all that. Likewise, an influencer just sells his face and his personality and his audience.
It's going to be interesting to see what approach they take because you know what I've noticed, Majid, with like different media channels, like for example, on Bloomberg, on the BBC, on Sky News, they collaborate with the journalists. Even on KT Plus, they collaborate with the journalists' account, even if there's someone completely relevant. And even I saw on Brut, I was watching this video of like these women who were naked in the streets of Paris, I believe it was, and they were protesting against the genocide in Gaza. And I was looking at the caption and it said, this video was taken by our journalist XYZ. It's like with these media channels, it's going to be interesting because they either promote the personalities or they promote the brand and only the brand.
The funny story about this is that in when you go to conventional media, so you go to TV, every reporter, whenever he's giving a PTC, which we do now on phones are, he's doing a PTC, oh, I'm here standing reporting, he always says his name. That gives him legitimacy, that gives his name legitimacy, and then in the future, he can become a bigger person, like, see, I've done this report. In newspapers, you used to have bylines. Like, oh, written by Abdul Majid, written by Word, written by this, written by that. That would be your portfolio, which you'll present to people. On digital media, the collaboration is that kind of a thing. That I am reporting for you, the National News, for example, or KT, I need a byline. I just don't need my face. I need a byline. And that byline has become your Insta profile, your TikTok profile.
Exactly.
So this conversation I had with the person who is working right now in one of the media companies, and they're like, yeah, this is the way to give us a byline. This is our contribution and which gives us like some followers as well.
Not all media companies do it.
Not everyone does it.
It's going to be interesting to see how
I think the problem is that it's redundant. Bylines no longer matter.
They're not redundant though.
They are redundant. The idea of a byline is redundant because now the focus is not on, oh, this guy has written an opinion piece and I will read it. Like Noam Chomsky, the best writer in the world I know on politics and business and anything, the way he mixes everything. When he wrote something, I would read the headline and then I'll read the byline first. And I'll be like, oh, Chomsky wrote it, I will read it 100%. Only those people, the bylines matter because Chomsky doesn't need the byline. He doesn't need his name on an article to get legitimacy. The newspaper actually puts his name to give legitimacy to that piece of content. So the idea that a reporter or any person can have a byline or be collaborated, it will give them legitimacy, it's lost. If I was a media company, I would collaborate with one of the people who works for me who has a following. Because I would want to take advantage from that.
So you think that it should have a following?
Yeah, the person who is you're collaborating with.
I don't agree with you, Matt.
The media house's job is not to give the person legitimacy. It's just the person that he should already have a digital media presence. Because now, if you're working in digital media, if you haven't done it, you don't know how to do it.
Look, Majid, I'm not saying it's their job. It's definitely not their job. It really does depend on the kind of theme that a brand, a company, a media company is going for. If you're going for the kind of media company that is like wants to lead with, you know, that kind of like authenticity, human aesthetic, I understand why they would collaborate with people. But I do see a point in it because, like, for example, I follow KT Plus, and there's this one girl. I do not remember her name. I don't remember her name, but I do follow her now. And I actually keep up with them just for this one person because I love the content that she produces. And even though she's not famous, not famous whatsoever, when they collaborated with her, it's like, to me, that was like, okay, I'm going to come back every single time to support this channel specifically for this one person. And that's how it is with the internet. You never know who is watching.
You don't know her name.
I don't remember it, but I follow her. The point in it is the fact that it's like we go back to these specific channels for you never know who is watching in the media. You don't know who keeps up with things. And it's like for me, the second that I was like, okay, they're collaborating with her. It's like subconsciously, I'm like, okay, this is someone important. I'll come back and I'll watch. Okay. It does not even have to be necessarily me remembering the name, but I do think there is a point in it because it gives life to the account because credit is an important thing.
I'll give you a very simple example. You know Issa.
Oh, right? Yes.
Why do you know him? Because he was a content creator before he joined Monify or before he did.
That's actually not why I know him.
No, a lot of people know him.
Probably most people, but I know him because they collaborated their accounts.
No, Issa, a lot of people know him already. A lot of influencers who are there on Monify, Upten, all these guys, they already had a legitimate whole presence. When they collaborated Monify, they contributed to Monify. That's the idea now. If you're an influencer, you contribute to the media and the media pays you that money to keep you on their profile with your face. A media will never build your profile and it shouldn't be like that, to be honest. It's a very weird idea that a company that is paying you money helps you create your identity. No, you should have a separate identity of your own. And when you go and join that media, you say, see, this is my digital presence now. And in this age, you should have a digital presence all across. Omnipresent, as they call it. You should have a good LinkedIn, you should have a good Instagram, you should have, not Facebook, Facebook doesn't matter now in this age, a Snapchat, at least TikTok. So whenever you go to a digital platform or any media nowadays, you go to any media like Kalish Times, The National, who also run a newspaper now, which again redundant, they're just doing it for the sake of it. But now you have to go and add, and then you can also demand money over it. I don't think Issa would have gone to Monify and be like, okay, 5,000, I'll be happy, or 10,000 or 20,000. He's getting a lot of money because he brings a personality to your platform. That is how now media will grow. They won't. I remember we went to this, what was the startup event? We went to for 2 days, Step. So we went to Step. One of the people from Monify actually came and it was a really nice discussion. And there was an idea between me, Rich, and that guy floated that you could have been a very nice influencer aggregation platform where all the influencers made their content, they put it on your website and you just, like, it's like Netflix for influencers. We floated that idea and that guy was like, yeah, literally we're doing that. We brought all these influencers, aggregated in on a single platform, like brought them all on a single platform. It's that kind of an idea.
I see what you mean.
It matters, to be honest. For young journalists, I would love them to be collaborated, to be added, to have their bylines. But how digital media is growing, channels don't want to do that. They want to build their own name. And to be honest, they're giving the money to everyone.
It's
a good idea.
Look, that does make sense. But at the same time, the way that I think about it is, you know, does faceless media breed loyalty? No, it does not. Because imagine, like, I've been following so many journalists for so many years. And it's like, you look at their CVs, they've been working for these companies for like over 5 years minimum. Every single one of them, 5 years minimum for all these years. And it's like when they move from these companies, there's articles written about them. Oh, XYZ journalist has made the huge move to move from the BBC to Bloomberg. And so, you know, this is what I mean. Like, I wonder the fact that they were given these bylines, is that why they stayed for so long? It's almost
actually
as if
their
they
work.
Does that make sense?
It's actually their work. If you stay at a company for 5 years and don't do anything meaningful, like any one story which stands out on that particular day, and everyone looks at it and be like, oh, this is a great story and this reporter was behind it. If you haven't done anything over those 5 years, I think your work actually gives you that power. Like, people will say, oh, this person who did this story, like a person who took a photograph, won a Pulitzer, did a story, won a Pulitzer, all these people, they get that kind of push because they did something. They went into the field, they did something no one was thinking, or at least no one was daring to do. And then they got those like headlines like, this person is now moving to this place and this person. So, see, the idea is, digital media, the brand has to be stronger than the individual, because any day that individual can then threaten and be like, okay, bye.
So I don't think it's a threat.
We also have we were a very faceless account. Now we're doing PTCs. You're doing more than me. What does it? But we have some kind of a face now. People do relate with it. Lana will also have Blinks, the hosts. They're so flashy. They have a face. I remember we did a story. We got like their yearly report at the end of the last year. And we did a story. All of them shared it on LinkedIn, on Instagram. I would open the profiles of the shares and be like, They supported their own.
Sorry, what was the story about Blinks?
I think they crossed their million mark or something on views and anything, and we did a story on them.
Okay.
So that story, everyone literally shared it. You open any profile and be like, Blinks this, Blinks that, working at Blinks, working. So they pushed their story out through all those people. So the stronger you grow the brand, the stronger you will eventually grow.
Mm.
Yeah, but yeah, digital media, since we are there, so a long, long, long debate. You guys can tell us if you agree with her or me, or like you have a separate middle opinion. But let's move on to some serious things. Iran's Supreme National Security Council is reviewing whether to close the Strait of Hormuz, one of the world's most critical energy corridors, following overnight U.S. airstrikes on Iranian territory.
So the strikes, which are unprovoked, have intensified tensions in the region. Press TV, Iran's state broadcaster, confirmed no final decision has been made yet, despite rising calls from lawmakers in Iran in favor of the closure.
And Ismail Kosari, a commander in the Revolutionary Guards and member of Iran's National Security Committee, said Parliament leans towards shutting the waterway, but ultimately only the Supreme National Security Council has the authority to act.
So the Strait of Hormuz is vital, and it carries nearly 20% of global oil and gas shipments. So any disruption could shake energy markets, spike prices, and provoke a wider geopolitical fallout. And I, you know, with this entire story, Majid, the reason why it is so big, if this closure does occur, because what happens when oil prices go up?
Yeah.
The price for transporting all of these commodities that we all buy, that goes up because more oil is required to transport things.
Very simple terms, your coffee gets expensive, your burgers get expensive, your grocery gets expensive, whatever you import and export. Literally everything gets expensive.
So it will not just affect the Middle East, it's going to affect everyone in the world.
Yeah. And Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi declined to confirm the plan. This was reported by Reuters, by the way, the whole story, saying multiple options remain on the table. So they're thinking about it, but not as the only option. A decision is expected in the coming days as global markets and regional powers brace for potential escalation. It's a highly sensitive maritime zone. Let's see what happens. It's a very strategically placed strait because this side is closed. This side is the Arabian Gulf, and it's landlocked. So whatever comes out of here has to go through it.
Yeah.
So as soon as it goes through, and if they stop it, everything stops. And Middle East has been a hub for a lot of companies who set up a company here in the free zone. So they bring stuff from Europe, land it here, and then from here they take it to Asia. And Asian companies exactly same. They come, land it here, and then use the waterway to export it there.
Look, so, I think
it's just not oil; it's everything, literally.
It really is, and it would be something that would shock the market. But I think that in itself is the information that we need to pay attention to.
Yeah.
The fact that this is going to shock the market because, more than democracy, America cares about money. That's what they care about, capitalism, and this would greatly affect them. So I understand why Iran is using it as a negotiation tool to get what they need and deserve.
Yeah. And it's just, to be honest, it's a very weird whole scenario which was started by Israel. Again, unprovoked, illegal. It's a sovereign country. There's like 100 laws against it in the UN, not just Iranian laws. International laws, UN laws, which are against it. They did it. US stayed quiet for a few days, said we are not part of it. Then they jumped in. They made claims that we did this. But at the end of the day, it's a sovereign nation. In very correct political terms, it's a sovereign nation. They have the territorial right to do whatever they want. They've signed the NPT, which is a non-proliferation treaty, which, according to which, they cannot make a nuclear bomb. They can only use nuclear power to generate electricity. Just to give you a small example, this was very 4 or 5 years ago, but France, nearly half of its country for their electrical energy needs, they use nuclear energy. So if they can do it, any other European country can do it. Iran, if they've signed all the documents, they've asked the IAEA inspectors to come and check everything, and everything is in place, there is zero legitimacy for these attacks. Zero, literally said. So how can you expect them to not retaliate? And it's going to be self-defense because they never provoked it.
Yeah.
they were attacked and they replied back. And it's very simple self-defense.
Yeah, I get what you mean.
And the whole media,
I honestly, I completely agree with you. I think what the U.S. is doing to Iran, it's bullying. It's bullying. And you know, it's so interesting because it's a kind of bullying where what they're doing to Iran is to actually, in the simplest way possible, leave it left out of the economy. Yeah. Because, you know, Iran attacks. The U.S. attacks Iran. What happens next? Whatever they do that does happen next,
the Western media will paint it like, oh, Iran's aggression. No, bro.
Exactly. They're aggressive. Quiet. You know, they have nuclear power plants. And I think that's my point there, is that for the longest time ever, they have been trying to ostracize Iran out of the economy.
Yeah.
They do not want other countries to work with them to improve their economy because there is this insane fear that they will, you know,
outgrow
build
them.
Exactly. Exactly. That is exactly what it is. They're ostracizing them in the economy. And I think the fact that they have something that just geographically that does play to their advantage, I think that it is great to see, and it's going to be interesting to see what decision the
so
U.S.
the whole
does
world
take
is
next.
Now actually waiting for Iran's response, which is again very clearly self-defense. You're attacked, you have to reply back. That's basic, I think, logic. That's basic politics. That's basic self-defense. Whatever happens, the oil prices, the commodity price, everything will get affected. Let's see what they do. A very good news coming out of Egypt, very interesting. Egypt's top consumer fintech platform, Velu, is nearly half an hour away now because 11 p.m. EGX opens, 11 a.m. UAE time, and they're going to IPO. The highly anticipated listing on the Egyptian stock exchange will happen. It's called the EGX 30. The company, founded in 2017 by Walid Hassouna, is backed by EFG Holding and has grown into a market leader with 800,000 active users.
So Velu currently holds 25% market share in Egypt's consumer finance space, processing 16,000 daily transactions. They actually do buy now, pay later. And so despite economic headwinds, it posted EGP 420 million in profit for 2024, up from 230 million Egyptian pounds last year.
And Amazon recently acquired a 3.95% stake in the company via a block trade ahead of the IPO. This move reflects growing international confidence in Egypt's fintech sector, particularly in platforms offering accessible credit and seamless payment experiences.
And Velu's app has become a household name in Egypt, known for its Pay with Velu feature, reverse consumer finance, and prepaid cards. So the company's default rate remains below 1%, with 40% of its users accessing credit for the first time through the platform.
And look ahead, Velu plans to expand financing options from mobile top-ups to luxury cars through a single app interface, with more partnerships in the pipeline and a focus on younger users. The firm aims to become Egypt's leading daily use payment ecosystem. This whole interview, these whole numbers were taken from Hassouna's interview with the Enterprise. Very long interview, so I was like, just take the numbers, very important numbers. So, yeah, it's one of the stories that we usually don't cover Egypt a lot because we usually see the startup scene, but this company is so big in Egypt right now, and there's so many companies in Egypt that have, like, very strong Egyptian presence. There's M&T Halan. We do a lot of stories on them. Right now, it's a little silent period for them, but there's so many companies who are in the fintech space especially. And we do stories about them.
And
it's
imagine,
very nice to know this.
And they, you know, these Egyptian companies, they deserve to be covered more because the stories that are coming out of Egypt, I mean, they're so inspiring.
Yeah.
What, you know, the value that Egypt has, it's more than just its pyramids.
Yeah.
And I think the greatest example of this, it's Mustafa Kendall's Swivel. I mean, the story of Swivel, it's one that's going to be told for centuries in Africa. The fact that it was the first Arabic unicorn to be listed on NASDAQ, and when it occurred, there was like a huge celebration in Burj Khalifa. I believe that their logo was lit up there. But their story, it's also an interesting one because Majid, like, can you believe that these people went from being valued at over $1 billion to going down to $5 million? It is absolutely crazy.
But
it's to the point that it's so crazy because it's to the point that NASDAQ like they threatened that they would delist them. Yeah. And now we're hearing that they're expanding into the UK. Yeah. But basically the reason why they went down after they had such a quick success is because of the fact, it's because of COVID.
Yeah.
It's because of COVID. Basically during COVID, because people were in their homes. I mean, who's going to be
traveling?
Who's going to be using rides, you know? Yeah. No one's going to be using rides. So basically that's what happened. And I think for me, the entire point that I get out of Swivel when I think of Mustafa is that you need to diversify yeah. your business. And the person which has done this so successfully, it's Kareem.
Yeah.
So basically Kareem, they just announced in Pakistan that they would be...
they're closing their yeah. operations from July 18th.
They're discontinuing their ride hailing yeah. services. But even though they're doing yeah. that... In the market, they have Kareem Technologies.
Yeah.
They're hiring more people. You know, they're putting them into different services. Do you remember? I think it was...
It's tech services. Basically, it's back-end platform services. It's software engineers, all these guys that are getting the job.
And this is what I mean, Majid. Kareem was still able to stay in Pakistan, what? Because they diversified their
yeah.
businesses. So I think my point here is that, you know, these companies, they can rise more if you have more than one service to offer, and that is what Kareem has done. That is so strategic.
Kareem has such a nice core, Pakistani core, because the CEO is also Mudassir Sheikh. He's Pakistani. The MD in Pakistan was Junaid Iqbal. He was a judge on Shark Tank Pakistan. He was the MD there. He basically took Kareem from here to there. I remember Uber came first in Pakistan and they tried to capture the market because there was no one. Pakistan has a very bad, there is zero public transport system and a very bad private transport system. So Uber came and Kareem was like, good idea, we should also go. Uber shut down in a year. Kareem survived. So they've gone through like at least 7-8 years, nearly a decade. They tried to stay. They tried to stay afloat in the market. There's so many government problems. I cannot tell you even. So basically, Kareem and all these guys, when you register a company, a transport
yeah.
service company, you pay all the taxes, you pay all the registration fees, everything that's basic. But as soon as they started becoming popular, the government was like, that all is fine. You just paid the registration, everything, blah, blah, blah. But you're using our roads. So they imposed a new tax on them. It was called infrastructure something tax that you're using
but
our roads.
But it's the Pakistani people that are on the roads, though.
So they're like, your cars, you're registered under you, you're making a profit out of it, but you're using our roads. So they added another tax to it. So I remember
God, imagine,
my office...
Are you being serious?
I'm telling you the truth because I used Kareem for a few times when the car is in the workshop and everything.
Yeah.
So from my house, it's a 10-kilometer ride to my office in Pakistan. It would take me like 200 rupees and that's very low in terms of dirham. It's like 2 or 3 dirhams. But in Pakistan, 200, 300 rupees is a good amount. But as soon as that tax was introduced, it went up to 600. So it doubled, nearly doubled.
So no one's going to use Kareem.
Kareem was like, bro, we can't help it. We are running it like we run it throughout the world. We registered, we did everything.
Yeah.
These guys have put a new tax on us.
The government almost forced them out of the country.
Yeah, because a lot of private transport systems, they're owned by ministers.
So
the ministers don't want their businesses to suffer because of Kareem. But we have Yango now. I think there's InDrive that's there. A lot of players entered the market.
This is completely disappointing. It's literally first-hand evidence.
Kareem did not leave because Kareem is not doing good. Kareem left because it was a whole show that happened with them. Uber was like, thank you very much, not interested, we're leaving.
We're already in enough markets.
Uber was like, we don't care about all of this. We will work like we work in all the markets. Kareem was like, okay, we'll make way for you, we'll pay you.
And it's so interesting because I was reading the statement, what is his name?
Mudassir Sheikh,
the CEO. I was reading the statement of the CEO of Kareem in Pakistan, and he was saying that, you know, for years we kept this running, you know, despite the fact that there are safety issues concerned with women. You know, there are so many factors that go into this, you know, we remained extremely resilient in this market. So it you know, at least they feel a sense of accomplishment that they tried.
Yeah.
But I think this is a running implication that corrupt governments will force good businesses out of the country that actually almost help the people more so than the business in this case.
Yeah.
You know, for our final story of the day, global airlines are rapidly adjusting routes after the United States carried out the unprovoked illegal overnight strikes on 3 Iranian nuclear sites. Now, British Airways specifically and Singapore Airlines have cancelled flights to Dubai and Doha and Qatar, citing safety concerns.
And it's a big problem for me because my wife is traveling to UK, so I don't know what will happen. But she thankfully is not traveling on British Airways. She's traveling on one of the best airlines in the world, Emirates. So I hope it won't be a problem. Yeah. But Flight Radar 24 data shows a sharp shift in flight paths. Carriers are now avoiding. You must have seen those graphics where all the airplanes are like diverting over the Middle East. Everyone has seen those. But carriers are now avoiding airspace over Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Israel, with detours via the Caspian Sea, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia adding significant time and cost. The escalation follows Israel's June 13 strikes on Iran, which we already know about. And they're still continuing those strikes.
Now, industry analysts are warning that the situation poses a serious challenge to global aviation operations. Rerouted flights mean higher fuel burn, increased crew hours, and mounting delays. So the risks also evoke past aviation disasters, including the 2020 of Ukraine International Airlines Flight 752 in Iran.
And several governments are taking action. Japan has evacuated citizens via Azerbaijan, and New Zealand has dispatched a Hercules C-130J. It's one of the biggest planes in the world to support potential evacuations. Meanwhile, Israel has also fully closed its airspace and suspended outbound and inbound commercial flights.
Now, with tensions rising and the threat of further military action looming, aviation authorities worldwide are closely monitoring the situation. Now, a closure of the Strait of Hormuz or additional strikes could severely impact not only air travel, but also the global energy routes and the trade supply chains.
Yeah. Just to tell you a funny story, one of my friends works for Dinata in Pakistan in ground operations. So I was asking him, like, what's the situation? Because it's interesting how quickly all the flights have been rerouted. He sent me a long voice message because I just wanted to know what happens when these things happen. And he was like, I'll give you a very small story out of all the stories he's told me. He's like, one flight landed in Karachi from Dubai, I think. And he was like, as soon as the flight landed, they were told that we don't have a time for you and you will fly back. So just pack your bags and leave and go to the hotel. As soon as it's done, we'll tell you. So it's like, he's like, it's like a whole unhour procedure with all the captains. They sign off everything. And they, as soon as they reach the hotel, he's like, they were called, your flight is in half an hour. The whole crew ran back. So imagine this is the situation on ground right now, that you don't know. As you land, you give landing permissions. You have big airports. Dubai has one of the biggest airports. So you give landing permissions. But the problem is, as soon as you land, you don't know your next when you're flying out. Maybe it is 10 hours. Maybe it is 12 hours. And maybe after like half an hour, you'll be like, go, 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 go. So they're like crisis managing all of this, all the air reroutes. Very complicated operations when you go actually to the ground. The people that you see on the runway, the guys bringing the trolleys and everything, people are like overworked, overtimed globally, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Not only here, not only in the Middle East, not only in Karachi. Everywhere they're overworked because they don't know when which route will close and which route will open and which flight to land and then
that
what flight will...
That is a really good point, Majid, because often when these things happen, we don't think about the real human impact, the employees on the ground.
And he was telling me that they're doing 48-hour shifts and sometimes it stretches to 72 hours because...
Please tell me they're getting paid.
Yeah, obviously they get paid. They're like, just think of them as doctors. Because doctors do long shifts, right? They do 2 day shifts, 3 day shifts. Because the handover procedure is very complicated for a doctor to give. If they're into a surgery which is like 12 hours, 13 hours, it's very difficult to hand it over. Likewise, for airport operations, if the whole operation team is shutting out and another one is coming, the handover process is so difficult, so complicated, and so detailed. That is why they make one team work and till the time there is like a small pause where they actually can do that 1 or 2 hour of handover, then they actually change the shift. Because even if you miss one minor detail, the air routes, you know, the crazy one plane flying over other, you look at all those maps and you will realize that the planes are like overlapping. So everyone flies at a different attitude. They're literally flying together sometimes.
You know, Majid, you know why these people are honestly able to do all this like hard, grueling work? It is because of the region that they're surrounded by. It is because of the news that, you know, they're surrounded with.
Yeah.
Because you know, imagine if the kind of news that we read, imagine if it was the American journalists who were writing our news. I mean, come on, people would be afraid to go to work.
Yeah.
No one would go to work. They'd be like, okay, family, pack it up. It is time for us to get on a flight and go back home.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? So yeah. I think the fact that the people are still moving, people are still carrying out their obligations, it really does it really does speak to the kind of peaceful environment that we are in, the countries that we are a part of and the governments that we are a part of, because it is so easy in these kinds of situations to think, okay, I need to evacuate. I need an evacuation plan. I need a backup plan. So I think, you know, kudos to all of you who are doing all of this for us. And that's a wrap for today. Thank you so much for tuning into the Smashy Business Show. Make sure to follow us across all social media channels at Smashy Business and stay ahead with our daily newsletter. You'll find the subscription link in the description.
This has been a Smashy Business Show, a Smashy Business production, part of the Augustus Media Podcast Network. Thank you so much to our 1.5 million monthly listeners across all our platforms under the Augustus Media Podcast Network. You make this possible. If you're one of them, we appreciate you. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.